When do you ignore an offensive comment or unwelcome advance? And when do you speak up about it? Those kinds of calculations are all too familiar to many women. And at the Capitol, where relationships are everything and lawmakers hold all the cards, female lobbyists find that mental math even more complicated. And about two-thirds of the bills lawmakers introduced this year are now dead. We'll check in on some of the most notable measures that died this week on The Breakdown. Welcome back to The Breakdown, podcast listeners. I'm Julia Shumway, Senate reporter at the Arizona Capitol Times, joined in studio today by Dylan Rosenblatt, our courts and education reporter, and Andrew Nikla, our governor's office reporter. We are sadly missing our House reporter after spending something like 30 hours on the House floor over the last couple days. He's working from home today. We hope he's ready to come back for budget week this week. And for now, I'm going to pass off our hosting duties to Dylan Rosenblatt, because I wrote the cover story this week.
Thanks for the introduction, Julia. Budget is on the horizon, but we're not going to be talking about that just yet, because, like you mentioned, you did the cover story this week with some help from our governor's office reporter, Andrew Nikla, and you talked to a bunch of lobbyists about the dynamic that they have and almost like the power play that lawmakers have over them, specifically female lobbyists, I should say, is the how the power dynamic kind of works around here. But yeah, you talk to a bunch of lobbyists, male and female, about the divide between their area of work and how lawmakers are handling things. Give us a little bit of a complete overview of the general comments you receive from some of these lobbyists.
So we started out, first we were building on some pretty great work that Andrew did in the Yellow Sheet report a few weeks ago when everything went down with allegations against Senator Eugene T. Rita and Representative Cook. Andrew called up a whole bunch of lobbyists and asked them about the rules they had for their lobbying firms. And then as we were trying to develop this into a fuller story for the print newspaper, we tried to focus on one particular question. In the depositions that Senator Eugene T. Rita's accuser gave, she talked about how her testimony was discarded in the House investigation because she continued to send Eugene T. Rita friendly text messages, trying to maintain a professional relationship with this lawmaker who she felt really uncomfortable around. And we figured that maybe this is a common thing, right? The lobbyist-lawmaker power dynamic is one where lawmakers hold all the power and lobbyists have to decide, even if you're made uncomfortable, if you hear a sexually harassing comment or an offensive joke or anything of that nature, do you call it out or do you just ignore it, put your head down, and try to keep this relationship going because you need these lawmakers to vote on your bills?
So what were some of the reactions that you got to the questions that you were asking? Let's start with specifically the women that you talked to, because this is something that affects them in a completely different way than some of the male lobbyists may be reacting to the lawmakers in the state. So just tell me what exactly were some of the most like astounding things that you heard from some of these women?
I think something that really sums up this general theme we heard from a lot of these female lobbyists is something that Marilyn Rodriguez, a lobbyist at Creosote Partners, described. That one, a piece of advice she keeps in mind is something Ruth Bader Ginsburg's mother-in-law told Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was getting married. It's advice for how to stay happily married, but RBG found out it worked pretty well in the courtroom, and Marilyn believes it does too. And that advice is, it helps to be a little deaf sometimes. That when someone says something that you disagree with or you find offensive, in this case, it's easier to just pretend you didn't hear it and move on as opposed to trying to fight every little thing.
How realistic is that, though? I mean, I'm sure there are several lobbyists who have heard some pretty damning stuff. I mean, anybody who, outside of our newsroom, who may have looked at the Eugene T. Rita deposition, that's just one example of a person who had to go through that type of experience. I can't imagine there's people who sit idly by and ignore everything. Did Marilyn or did any of the other people you talked to get into examples of where exactly they may draw the line? Like, at what point would someone be like, no, like, I have to say something at this point. I can't keep ignoring this.
So one example of a place where many people I talked to said they would draw the line is if they personally witnessed, say, another lobbyist or another woman at the Capitol or anyone in general being harassed out in public somewhere. That's something where you step in, you call it out, you defuse that situation, and you rescue that person. This is something that's probably pretty familiar. If you ride public transit, you might see the drunk guy hitting on a woman on the light rail, and you'll see other women and men in some cases come up and try to rescue her and get her away from that situation. Another lobbyist I talked to, Stacey Morley, who's been around here for a long time, has pointed out that she feels like she doesn't get harassed, really, that maybe it's just that she's got this real brash, inappropriate personality. She joked that she loved Don Shooter, who, of course, was expelled over comments and actions the House investigators found he had that caused a whole lot of women at the Capitol to feel uncomfortable. But she said that maybe it's there's something that you have to, not to victim blame, but to say that if you give off this vibe of you're not going to mess with me, then maybe you won't be messed with.
So I know you predominantly talk to lobbyists for this story to kind of get their perspective on how they deal with lawmakers, but it's not just lobbyists that you found deal with these situations, it's other lawmakers. Get into a little bit, I know you talked to Representative Isela Blanc, a Democrat in Tempe. What did she have to say on the matter, like coming from a lawmaker's perspective and how she deals with some of her male colleagues?
So talking to Representative Blanc was really interesting. I ran over to the House to sit in on the House for a little while. I've got to say, I like the Senate much better. But while I was over there in the House waiting to speak to Representative Blanc, she tries to get on her mic, make a comment on a bill, and there's some back and forth between her and House Speaker Pro Tem T.J. Shope over whether she has pushed her button to speak in time to talk on a bill. And she yells back, "I pushed my button, I'm good at pushing my button." And some of the male House members found that absolutely hilarious. They were drawing innuendos from that. And so we're sitting there on the floor watching a lawmaker try to speak while a couple of her fellow lawmakers are just guffawing about what they have heard as a masturbation joke. And it's awful to witness. And so it was a interesting thing to talk to Representative Blanc after seeing that. And she brought up how she, as a Democratic lawmaker, feels like she's definitely not in power for a whole lot of reasons. And she has to wonder sometimes that if there are times when she feels like she can't speak up or call anything out, and she is supposed to be an equal elected official, how much worse must it be for people who aren't in that position?
Yeah, I mean, not to that extent, but there was a point last year where you had a situation with one of the male lawmakers who doesn't take women in general, let alone like female reporters and other female lawmakers as seriously, is something that we found from his Facebook page. Why don't you get into a little bit of that? Because I feel like that kind of plays into this whole power dynamic situation of these men, for some reason, don't feel comfortable enough to be able to sit one-on-one with a person of the opposite gender.
Right. So last summer, it was in the middle of a primary in Mississippi, and this gubernatorial candidate in Mississippi refused to allow a female reporter to ride along with him for a story unless she brought along a male companion. And instead of complying with this order from his campaign, the reporter wrote about it and how she was not being allowed to do her job just because she was a woman. This story went national, and Senator Vince Leach picked it up, and he said, "I totally agree with this. This has been my policy for a long time." I had called him up to talk about it. He never responded. He sent a statement through a spokesman at the time saying that it was his policy. He just does not meet with women alone, and that's what he does. I found out from Senate President Karen Fan this week that Senator Leach is not the only lawmaker who does that, that she knows of multiple male members of the legislature who have rules that if a woman wants to come and speak to them, they invite their assistant into the room or they keep the door open. There is one House member who she declined to name who had a woman ask him to if she could catch a ride down with him to Tucson. And he said that he turned her down, but if it had been a guy asking, he totally would have said yes.
What were some reactions to that? Because that has to make many people's jobs so much more difficult. Like, if you're a female lobbyist or a female lawmaker or a journalist, for that matter, your job relies on being able to talk to these people. And if they're not going to talk to you one-on-one, I'm curious what people do in that situation.
Right. So one thing that Marilyn Rodriguez brought up is that she noted that since Senator Leach said that, she's questioned every time she talks to him what he's thinking about when they're talking. Is he actually thinking about what she's saying or what any other woman talking to him is saying? Or is he just thinking, oh, this is a woman, this is dangerous, she might accuse me of something? And it also means that, I mean, it means you don't have the same access to male lawmakers as your male colleagues do. If you're a lobbyist, it means maybe you don't have privacy. If you're a reporter, I question a lot whether the lawmakers who follow this kind of policy, would they give, say, a tip to you that they wouldn't give to me just because I'm not a man? And it's something that Marilyn, for instance, pointed out when she goes to meet with these lawmakers. She'll occasionally go in there with her male colleagues and find that even when she's the subject matter expert on something, they will direct their questions to her colleagues. And she has to rely on them to, in turn, like, angle their bodies toward her or do other things to point out that she is, in fact, the person they should be talking to.
So I know a lot of this got started when Andrew was doing some of this reporting for Yellow Sheet a couple weeks ago. Andrew, you were kind of focusing a little bit more on where lobbyists have their own ethical concerns with how they deal with lawmakers. And one of the people you talked to kind of brought up that there is a similarity between how lobbyists deal with their own ethics that like journalists do. Who said that? And just give us a little bit of like background on what those two ethical differences and similarities are.
Yeah, so that was Matt Benson. He's a lobbyist for Veritas. He's a former Arizona Republic reporter. And when I asked him about what his code of conduct is and what his employees, like his fellow employees, follow, there really is no code of conduct. It's just a code of common sense. And he said that, you know, journalists and lobbyists aren't so different in the fact that they deal with the people that they work with, these sort of like professional adversaries, in a more casual way than most professions would. And there's kind of a blurry line, he says, and making any kind of rule book or trying to enforce those rules would make those lines even blurrier.
So as Matt Benson pointed out, both journalists like us and lobbyists have more casual relationships with sources than you might say, I don't know, you're a salesperson dealing with a client. But journalists have a written code of ethics. We have the Society of Professional Journalists Code, which we've all received countless copies of through jobs and school. And it's very clear about some things, like that you don't date your sources. If you do, like, you are off that beat. That you don't take gifts or other things from sources, and you have to do everything you can to avoid even a perceived conflict of interest. Are there any kinds of lobbyist codes of ethics out there?
There is no general agreed upon code of ethics for Arizona lobbyists. There are some states like Colorado and I think California, they have an association, some sort of organized group of lobbyists that have made a list of these rules that they felt could help curb these like problematic instances, and they like enforce those in many different ways. But again, we have no rules here. I mean, like, we have some vague laws and guidelines, but it's mostly up to the individual like lobbyists and their companies. Like, according to Benson and Barry Ahrens, he's the, you know, like, de facto dean of lobbyists, they both told me that if they or their employees were caught having inappropriate like relations with other lobbyists or lawmakers, they would have to disclose that, and they would either be ripped off that beat or they'd be fired entirely, or just, I mean, like, it just depends on the severity of the case. But they assured me that there would be appropriate consequences.
And I know you also talked to former Representative Maria Sims, who does not think that this idea of just a code of common sense is quite cutting it. What did the former lawmaker have to say?
She said that whole idea of leaving the rules vague makes no sense at all. She said that the longer you leave these rules and guidelines and lack of like uniform enforcement, the longer that it sort of like promotes this, like this environment for these things to happen. And she was actually one of the more vocal members of the state house at the time when Shooter, when a former representative Shooter was being expelled. She was calling for then Speaker Mesnard to adopt some formal code of ethics, some formal code of conduct to get the frat house out of the state house. And that, and actually Speaker Mesnard's idea of having a dry campus never like materialized. So, you know, she said like these efforts to fix these situations, those things and these situations are both swept under the rug and business as usual continues.
I do want to hit on this concept of a dry campus again, because one of the things that I heard from several of the lobbyists I spoke with is that they avoid alcohol when they're out with lawmakers. They want to eliminate anything that could possibly be risky. I know there have been some rumblings of maybe that being a policy lobbyists will adopt by themselves, but how likely is that?
There was a anonymous source who told us that there were a couple groups who were informally talking about, you know, either adopting like a rule, either like amongst themselves or sort of like proposing it to like the lobbying corps in general to stop buying lawmakers' drinks. But I asked those groups that were rumored to have had those talks, and they did not admit to that. And I asked Barry Ahrens about this, and he said that it would be a shame if that were to happen, you know, like banning casual drinks, casual meals with what we see as like their counterparts, because to him that's not really a lobbying strategy. It's just a part of basic social interaction, and just like limiting that and making this very loose, like this very like intentionally loose like set of guidelines more rigid would make their work harder, and yeah, just harder.
So while there might not be a hard and fast rule, especially something that's maybe not likely to be adopted by the lobbyist corps in the state, there are ways that some lobbyists go around not having drinks with some of their lawmakers that they're going to have lobby bills. There was one lobbyist that you talked to for our story, Julia, that went on to Twitter after the story was posted and gave her first person experience of harassment that she went through and gave examples of what she does now to no longer go drinking with lobbyists. Do you want to get into that a little bit?
Yeah. So one of the lobbyists I spoke to, Tori Roberg, brought up after we talked the first time that it felt kind of therapeutic to talk through this very, very weird dynamic that lobbyists and lawmakers have down here. And mentioned that it made her think some about how messed up the Capitol can be sometimes. And after our story published on Friday morning and she read it, she said reading it inspired her to share more than she was comfortable sharing initially. And so she explained that a few years ago, she had gone out for drinks with a lawmaker. They both drank more than they probably should have, and he tried to pressure her to go upstairs with him and continued pressuring her over the course of several months to engage in sexual relations with him. And while she declined and kept telling him no and tried to do that awkward balancing act of telling him no while also keeping him friendly enough that he would vote for her bills or support what she was putting out there, she said that it taught her to not go to drinks or dinner with lawmakers anymore, to keep their meetings to coffee and lunch, things done during the daylight hours, and not to drink out at Capitol events, that if you see her walking around an event with a drink, it's probably a Diet Coke. that kind of solution is something that was pretty common among other women we've talked to about this. And one of the last things that Tori mentioned when I was texting with her after she put up her Twitter thread was that she hopes that maybe more women are comfortable coming forward and talking about this. And I hope so too. So if you are, I'm here, I'm listening, I'd love to write about what is happening at the Capitol, and you can always reach me. But for now, we are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we are going to get into all of the bills that have died, or not all of them, some of the bills that have died already this session. We could not list all of them, because something like 1,000 bills are already dead after lawmakers introduced a record 1,707 pieces of legislation this year. It is absolutely insane. We don't know what you were doing. But when we come back, we'll talk about some of those that are not moving ahead.
Can't wait for your weekly Arizona Capital Times? Then subscribe to the Yellow Sheet Report. The Yellow Sheet Report brings you the latest news and hottest political gossip in town every day, thanks to our trusty team of reporters. And with the legislative session right around the corner, there's no better time than now to get in the know with the Yellow Sheet Report. Learn more at yellowsheetreport.com today.
Welcome back, Pod Squad. Let's talk about dead bills, Julia. Like you said, there was 1,707 pieces of legislation that includes bills and referendums, and roughly two-thirds of those, and I don't want to do mental math, but it's around 1,000-plus pieces of legislation, ended up going nowhere. What were some of the big topics of discussion from this session that ended up not going anywhere?
Oh my gosh, there were so many dead bills, but probably the most critical, definitely the one that the area that got the most attention and continues to get the most attention every year is criminal justice reform. Each year we start the session saying, this will be the year, Republicans agree on it, Democrats agree on it, they're going to pass meaningful changes to the criminal justice system. And right now, if I'm counting correctly, we have two bills alive that might make changes. Is that right?
That sounds right. I know one of them, Representative Walter Blackman, a Republican in Snowflake, Arizona, had his earned release credits bill that just made it through the House on Thursday, I believe 60-0. So it passed unanimously. So at least there's something coming from Republicans. But yeah, I mean, all of us at this point have been reporting on these criminal justice bills, and Arne and I both happened to be in the House Judiciary for one of their committee hearings when Chairman John Allen decided to pretty much kill all of them because one of his bills was being held.
Yeah, we mentioned in our cover story this week, actually, that any kind of policy that's been worked for on months can be killed on the whim of a single lawmaker, and you saw that in action with criminal justice reform.
Other bills that died, one of them specifically happened on day one of the legislative session, which was, if I recall correctly, about 3 years ago, or at least it feels like 3 years ago. I mean, it's only been not even two full months. It's just the start of March right now as you guys are listening to this. But on day one of the legislative session, Sylvia Allen had a very controversial sex education bill that, Julia, you and I both covered that story. You so more than I did. You've been keeping up with it since covering the Senate is your job. What remind us what that bill was and then why we never ended up seeing anything else sex ed for the rest of the session so far.
Right. So that was, I think, one of our first late nights here this session, far from the last late night. Senator Sylvia Allen introduced a bill that would ban the teaching of sex ed at any point prior to seventh grade. and also, as written, appeared to ban the discussion of homosexuality in sex ed courses at all, which is would have been a huge rollback of the no promo homo repeal they were able to pass last year. And so Senator Allen received some national attention for this bill, and our Senate president was not having that. Basically, she refused to give the bill a first reading. She told Senator Allen it wouldn't be heard. Senator Allen went ahead and held an informative hearing in her Senate Education Committee on it anyway. But it was the first of many bills that we saw President Fan kill this year by not assigning them to committees because she didn't want to deal with anything controversial.
How quickly things changed, too, because I remember when we were doing a session preview, a lot of lobbyists and lawmakers and other sources that we have were telling us, pay attention to sex ed this year. It's going to be the biggest battle for education. And that battle lasted really less than a week. We haven't seen any sex ed bills in either chamber at this point. I know there was some talk that some aspects of Sylvia Allen's bill would come back, but nothing ended up happening with that.
And in addition to sex ed, one of the issues that was kind of tied into sex ed in some cases were bills that Representative John Fillmore wanted to introduce to address gender identity, and mostly you should identify with the gender you were assigned at birth, right?
Yes. Fillmore and Representative Gabaldon had dueling bills. His bill would have prohibited a state agency from printing a ID or any kind of birth certificate with a gender that was not male or female. And Gabaldon's bill would simply allow people to put, put non-binary on their driver's license, even if they don't drive, just their state ID, like rather than just male or female. If they don't identify with either one, she said it's not controversial. So she didn't understand why it couldn't have gotten a hearing.
All right. And both of those bills did not receive a hearing. One section of bills that in some cases did receive hearings, but for the most part are dead, are marijuana related. Dylan, what's the state of marijuana legislation at the Capitol? And for our listeners, can you get into why it's just so tough to pass marijuana bills?
Let me start with why it's so tough, and that comes down to who is the top dog in each of the chambers. And we were at a morning scoop event that the Arizona Capitol Times hosts typically once a month, but I feel like they've been happening more often lately. Feel free to come to one of those events for those who are listening. At one of them, Senate President Karen Fan and House Speaker Rusty Bowers both said and committed to not hearing any marijuana-related, at least in legalization effort, bills in either one of their chambers. So if anybody was going to file one of those bills, good luck. It's not going to get assigned. It's not going to come to the floor. They're not going to let it happen. Both of them are against legalizing adult-use marijuana, which will likely be on the ballot in 2020 in the form of a ballot initiative that we've extensively covered. But outside of that, we had two attempts from Democrats, one in House Assistant Minority Leader Randy Freese and Representative Isela Blanc each had their own attempt at legalizing marijuana through the legislature, where it wouldn't go to the ballot, it wouldn't be voter protected. Neither one of them received a hearing in the committee. A lot of it comes down to most bills from Democrats don't get hearings or don't make it to the floor. So those were almost dead before anything could have taken off.
And beyond the bills introduced by Democrats, which, as you pointed out, have very slim chances here in our Republican-dominated legislature, there were some marijuana bills introduced by Republicans, which are now dead. Can you get into the Voter Protection Act and why Senator Sonny Borelli continues to hit brick walls as he tries to regulate the medical marijuana industry?
To paraphrase Senator Borelli, blame the Democrats. In order for you to amend something that was approved on the ballot, you need 3/4 in both chambers, which means Republicans and Democrats need to work together. And that's why you see a lot of things ended up going to the ballot to change constitutional amendments or to undo some aspects of initiatives or referendums is because nobody wants to work with the other party. And Senator Borelli, although in his words, like, these bills are intended to further what the Arizona Medical Marijuana Act may do regarding testing of marijuana and some that have pesticides in them, he needs a lot of Democrats to vote with him, and he keeps blaming them because none of them will end up voting for it. And so he had another effort that would test marijuana, and it failed in the Senate. And he told me before the session started that they'll keep bringing these back until they go through. So he's still keeping his head up. He's hopeful that maybe eventually some of these Democrats will come around, but at this point, his best effort may just be to try to send something to the ballot and hope that the voters can do something with it.
And definitely keep an eye out in the next week or so for some more reporting from Dylan on ballot initiatives. Maybe not necessarily the one that Sonny Borelli's introducing, but ballot initiatives. And with that, we are just about done for this week. Thank you to Dylan Rosenblatt and Andrew Nikla for joining me here today, and to Dylan for hosting the first half of our show and co-hosting our second half here, and to Aaron Kimball-Sanit, who is not here but has spent more time in the House than any sane person should. Thank you for doing that. And continue checking out our reporting in the Arizona Capital Times, in the Legislative Report, and in the Yellow Sheet Report. With that, it's been great talking to you, and we'll be back next week.